You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Cressa, your commercial real estate advisors. This is your host, John Schuhart from Graybeard Coaching, with my co-hosts from Cressa, Mindy Saffer and Lauren Rizzo. We have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Bill Dombey, President of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice, Luca Sicoccio, CEO of the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Forum, Matt Ramsey, President and CEO of Exivity, and Shantanu Agrawal, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Bill Dombey, President of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. Bill, what is the National Association for Home Care and Hospice?
The National Association is the trade association representing the interests of home care and hospice providers nationwide. We have a membership of small, large, public companies, every type of home care and hospice organization in the country.
How small is the association?
The association right now is about a $9 million budget with 29 employees.
And how'd you get involved?
I became involved actually from an interest that was from the association back in the late 80s. They wanted to sue the Medicare program, and I was a big-time lawsuit litigator against Medicare back then.
And so that led to your, how'd they rope you in?
They roped me in because they demonstrated to me that home care and hospice providers share an interest that I had, which was to protect Medicare beneficiaries and other beneficiaries who wanted to stay receiving their care at home, an intimate relationship between both provider and patients that I did not see in other sectors of healthcare.
And speaking of home, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a small mill town called Torrington, Connecticut, northwestern Connecticut in the Berkshire Hills.
And any brothers or sisters?
I have one brother and two sisters. My oldest sister is now deceased.
Now tell us about your mom.
Well, my mother was the life of the party. She was the most gregarious person that I knew or that seemed anybody knew at that point. She was a stay-at-home mom for most of her life, but once we were a little bit older, she went to work. She worked at a factory in Torrington, Connecticut. Pretty much everybody in Torrington worked at a factory at one point in their life.
And what'd she do at the factory?
It was a needle factory, so she was an inspector of needles to see whether or not they met the quality standards that they had.
Okay, and you said your dad also did some factory work. What did he do?
My father was a person who had just incredible mind and hands combination. He was a toolmaker. He actually designed and then built the tools that worked on these unique manufacturing machines.
Okay, what did you get from your dad?
I got a work ethic from my father, believing that the harder that you work, the better off that you would be, the greater the opportunities that you would have.
And how do you see that showing up today at the association?
It shows up probably at the association with the culture I'm trying to see there for everybody. But we're doing a little different perhaps than my father. From my father, it was all about work, work, work for the betterment of the family. And what I'm trying to bring into the association is a little more balance and allowing people to have a life in addition to work.
Mm-hmm. And what's your personal connection to home care and hospice? You said that was one of the things that really drew you there.
Well, back when I was a lawyer in Connecticut running a Medicare advocacy beneficiary firm, we represented beneficiaries and challenges on Medicare payment denials and such. I came in contact with local home health agencies, and we embraced each other as partners in caring for patients that way. And one other thing, as you think about it, just on a going forward basis, it is the best option for care. It is the safest option for care. It is the highest, most satisfaction rated location for care. People want to be cared for at home, and I could identify with that. But there was another element of me, I think, that played a part in that. I've always kind of liked taking on the underdog role, and home care was bucking the medical industrial complex. It was bucking the bricks and mortars of hospitals and such, and so I looked at it as not only innovative, but kind of like the David versus Goliath.
So when's the first time as a kid you stood up to protect or defend someone else?
My brother, 2.5 years younger, was being bullied at the time. And while I was certainly no Rocky in terms of my physique or boxing capabilities, I stood between him and his bully and said, "You're coming through me."
And how did that work out?
It worked out well for my brother and for me. We never had to have any physical contact because he was pretty young, so I meant the bully was pretty young too.
So what is your first recollection of actually working?
My first recollection of actually really, really working was a paper route that I had. We needed, to help fund our own life when we were kids back then. And I took on a paperwork where my decision was the best way to please the customers was to be the first person in the city to deliver newspapers to anybody. So I was at the presses as they came hot off the presses. I put them on my bicycle baskets and I rode my bicycle halfway across town to deliver the papers before anybody else got there. So it was hard work, particularly riding a bicycle in snowy streets in Connecticut.
And as far as the biggest challenge of that particular type of work, what would you have said when you look back? What did you not like about that?
I liked every piece of it. The hardest part of it was it was 6 days a week, and you had to be there on time to pick up the papers, and you had to find your way to each and every one of your customers, and then you had to collect the money from the customers too. I would make 7 cents a week on each newspaper customer.
Wow. And what did you do with your money back then?
Oh, I was a kid. So I spent it on comic books and candy, but I did have a little bit of a savings mentality. I wanted a transistor radio. And so when I saved up enough to go to Sears and buy my transistor radio, I was like as proud as I could ever be of my accomplishments, having built that capital.
Lauren?
So you have two children. What type of father are you?
A father who's probably apologized more than fathers should have to, but I took on too much of my father's ethic and missed birthdays and did other kinds of things for work purposes. I'm trying to make up for that now with my grandchildren.
Do you feel that your children have forgiven of that and understood?
Well, strangely enough, I think my kids really like me. I'm not so sure I like myself as a father, but they are really happy with where they are. They are both really tremendous kids, and they like me as a granddad as well. So they have maybe applied a different standard to me as a father than I applied to myself.
And how is running an association similar to being a father?
Oh, please don't take me down the human resources path. there are those things that happen, as a father that you're doing within your organization too. You do have to show empathy. You do have to be emotionally connected with your staff, but not too deeply so. But you have to recognize that they are people. You have to respect them as individuals who might have a completely different outlook on life to you. But at the same time, recognizing that they are there for a job. So you don't treat them as children, you don't treat them as your children, but you do treat them with the respect that you would want to see coming from a parent to a child.
Do you feel that the way you run the organization now has changed since you've become a grandfather versus the way you saw it when you were just a father?
Well, the main change is they have to listen to my grandchild stories and see the grandchildren's pictures. I think it has changed. I think one of the things that the grandchildren have brought to me is that desire to look even further into the future. So for the organization, looking at the future of the organization, just as I'm looking at the future of the lives of my grandchildren.
Before the show, you told us a story about a time when your role as a father intersected with your role as the president of the association. Can you tell us about that?
Well, home care and hospice, is a passion that I have, but it's also a personal experience that I've had. My father, my mother, my mother-in-law, my sister all have been home care and hospice patients, but the strongest connection was in the early stages of my son's life. He was not thriving as an infant. He had a liver condition that's still never been diagnosed, but with severe asthma, and he was going to a hospital 15 times a year. And I took my passion for home care and my knowledge and my connections to create an opportunity for him to be cared for at home. Now an opportunity which everyone has. The insurance companies wouldn't pay for infusion of drugs back then under the insurance plans. Today, everybody does it. It is commonplace. So we got my son out of the hospital pretty much for his entire life since then because we brought him home, and we became his caretakers. We were the ones who gave him infusion of drugs.
And how did that change how you approach your work at the association?
It only amplified my passion. Recognizing that home care is the better place to be for healthcare services, but also recognizing that we have yet to see the ceiling for what you can do in the home, that innovation is a daily part of what goes on in care and home.
So that really fuels your passion then, making home care more affordable and accessible to people.
And I think passion is the absolute correct word on that. I mean, this is something which not only the staff and I have, but the parties who provide the care and the family members who are crucial to making it work, it is a passion driven.
What's your website?
The website is nahc.org.
We've been speaking with Bill Dombey, president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. This is John Schuhart with my co-hosts from CRESA, Mindy Saffer and Lauren Rizzo. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Schuhart from Greybeard Coaching, with my co-hosts from CRESA, Mindy Saffer and Lauren Rizzo. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Lou Sicoccio, CEO of the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association. Lou, what is the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association?
NHCAA, the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association, is a private-public partnership. We were formed back in 1985, and our members consist of health insurance plans, in addition to many federal, state, and local law enforcement and regulatory agencies. And the concept is to bring the payers together, the private payers and the public payers, to share information about healthcare fraud, to do educational programs. You know, in this country, we spend more than $3 trillion on healthcare every year. You know, at least in the tens of billions, certainly, there's fraud in the system. So it's really important that you go after that, and that's what our organization does.
How large or how small is the association?
The staff itself is small. We have 12 employees, 12 staff, about a $5 million budget.
And how did you get involved?
Prior to joining NHCAA, I was general counsel for America's Health Insurance Plans, which is the trade association for the health insurance industry. I was general counsel and then senior vice president of professional services. So I was very familiar, certainly, with the health insurance industry.
Where'd you grow up, Lou?
Grew up in New York City, Manhattan first as a kid. And when I was about 10, we moved up to the Bronx.
So you were in the ritzy part of Manhattan?
No, it was a neighborhood called East Harlem, which was, anybody that's seen the movie West Side Story, this was the east side of Manhattan, but it was kind of that kind of environment.
Any brothers or sisters?
One brother, younger brother, who's a pediatrician.
Okay, and what'd your dad do?
My father started out on construction. He was a bricklayer and then worked on railroad. Then started driving trucks, delivering electrical supplies, and then in his 30s actually went back to school and was able to become an electrician, join the electrical union in New York City.
Well, sounds like a real classic bootstraps up story.
Oh, yeah. And he worked a lot of side jobs. For a few years, he drove a cab on the weekends. Had a lot of great stories about driving a cab in New York City. But he was always trying to make money and take care of the family.
Yeah. So what did you learn from your dad that shows up in anti-fraud work?
Well, I think he... you know, that determination to always try to do better. He always told me, my brother, that we were going to go to college. We were really the first ones in our family to go to college. I think that determination and work ethic is a big part of it. No matter what you do in life, that's important. And certainly dealing with in the area that I work in, it's important.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your mom.
My mom, when we were young, was basically a stay-at-home mom, took care of us, very family-oriented. We were very close to her parents, my grandparents, always had Sunday dinner over the grandparents. As we got older, she worked at an optical store, sold eyeglasses. She worked there as a receptionist and a secretary. She was always the really family-oriented one. in the field.
Mindy, what questions do you have for Lou?
Well, when you think about your childhood, what kind of role did you play in the family dynamic?
Well, I was the older brother, and you know, did well in school, and so I became kind of the one that was expected to do well in school and expected to do well as I went forward. So not only my parents but grandparents on both sides expected that my brother and I would take that next step that they weren't able to take.
So with a younger brother, what did you feel your relationship as the older brother really was with the younger brother?
My brother was, when we were younger, he was kind of annoying as a younger brother. But he was only 14 months younger than me, so we were very close in age. And we fought from time to time, but we still see each other, still are fairly close. We actually went to different high schools, but kept that relationship, not as the annoying, little brother, but certainly as a physician now.
So you were a general counsel within an association, and then you became the CEO.
Yes.
Did you feel that because of your upbringing and your role in your family, the CEO position felt more comfortable than being a general counsel?
Actually, it did. I actually made the choice to move from the general counsel position to the business side of the association when I was at America's Health Insurance Plans. Because I have a Navy background. I was in the Navy. And any naval officer will tell you that the ultimate goal is command. And so being able to take a position as a CEO was exciting and something I've always wanted to do.
Lauren?
Yep. Just to go back to your childhood a little. So your dad's working all these jobs to provide for the family, but yet you have this expectation to excel academically. Was there any part of you that really just wanted to go out and work and help provide as well, being the eldest?
Well, my father was, he actually refused to let us do that. When we were in high school, he told both my brother and I that he didn't want us to work while we were in high school. He wanted us to focus on grades, on sports, to do really well so that we could get into whatever college we wanted to get into. Because he started working when he was 10 years old, delivering supplies from a horse and buggy, believe it or not, down in New York City. So he knew what it was like to work in physical labor and to work hard, and he wanted something a little better for us.
I can imagine he's very proud of you.
Yes.
What was your role? You said you did cross-country and track. What was your role on those sports?
Well, I was, I ran cross country and track, but I was a sort of a disciplined, maybe a little over the top on it. And our coach used to say that I was sort of an assistant coach in the sense that he knew if I was out there with everyone else and he wasn't watching, that I would be pushing folks along. So,
so basically, you've been training to be a CEO since you became a big brother.
Yeah, maybe in a sense. Again, it was that always wanting to do your best and achieve the best that you can. And so that, I think, was a big part of it.
So what do you pass down from your mom and dad to your kids and granddaughters?
Well, I think the first thing is family. The importance of family, the importance of supporting each other, the importance of, for example, just early this week, I was at my granddaughter's field hockey game with my son and daughter-in-law, that kind of thing. Always supporting what family is doing. If anybody needs any help, always being there to help.
And how does being a grandfather translate to being a CEO?
I think you get a good appreciation for life, and as a CEO, probably the biggest responsibility you have is the people that work for you and work for the association, and they have children of their own, and you really get, as you grow older and see different generations, I think you start to really appreciate the importance of people and how to deal with people as a CEO.
What's your website, Lou?
The website is nhcaa.org.
We've been speaking with Lou Sicoccio, CEO of the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Schuhart from Graybeard Coaching, with my co-hosts from Cressa, William Tidwell, and Justin Long. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Matt Ramsey. What is Exivity, Matt?
Exivity is a technology and product development company, and we've got about 45 people that are outstanding creative engineers.
How'd you get involved?
I started the company and founded it back in 2006 after having exited the government and going into the commercial sector, and wanted to create an environment that had the leadership and creative aspects that I wanted within a company.
So where'd you grow up?
I was born in Southwest Georgia, and my dad was an engineer on the railroad and ended up going into the government and exfiltrating us from the area and taking us overseas. So I got to grow up in Rio de Janeiro and Geneva, Switzerland before returning back to the U.S.
So did that spark a desire and love of travel?
It did. It's something that's been ingrained in my blood. I've lived overseas as an adult in two other countries and traveled to probably 55 countries overall.
So what's the most interesting place you've ever been?
Wow, that's a good question. One of my most interesting places is actually New Delhi, India. It's such a dynamic environment there.
So, okay. Well, maybe we'll come back to that travel theme in a minute. What'd your mom do?
My mom was stay-at-home early on, and then as we aged and grew up, we needed to go to college, and so she went back to work and helped fund that so we could exit college debt-free.
I hear the word we several times there. Who's the other people in this we?
Yeah, so I've got two older brothers, and so I was the youngest of three and ended up having to fight for what I wanted and was kind of left to fend for myself and what I wanted.
Wow, it sounds like kind of a Darwinian existence. Tell me more about that.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, you do model yourself after your family. You're both your parents as well as your older siblings if you've got them, and you're a role model for your younger siblings. And so my older brothers were both very dynamic in what they did growing up and ended up actually following in their footsteps and things that I did in service as a youngster. And then both of them ended up going into volunteer firefighting, and so I became a volunteer firefighter and EMT that I did while working and also going to college at the same time.
So you're not afraid of taking a risk, it sounds like.
I am not. Early on, I tinkered around with technology and did some risky things with technology.
Like what?
Like one of the examples early on, I was trying to play around with lasers, and back then we didn't have LEDs, so we had plasma tube lasers, and I needed to get the thing to actually lase, which required a high voltage power supply. So I started taking apart old cathode ray TVs and using the power supplies in them, which are somewhere in the 8,000-9,000 volt, but had to play around to figure out by arcing them and calculating the dielectric breakdown of air and, you know, how much voltage did I have?
So what did your mom think about your playing around with high voltage lasers and power sources at home?
This might be the first time she's hearing it. I don't know. There's a lot of things that I did that they don't necessarily know about, but I survived.
I guess so. I can just hear the old mom line, "You're going to put an eye out. Be careful with that." It certainly could have happened with lasers. Justin.
Matt, I'll never forget walking in your office for the first time and seeing a parachute draped across the ceiling in your rafters. Can you tell us a little bit about that, the design inspiration?
So it's a reminder of risk management, actually, which is something that plays into being an executive in a company. But I am a pilot, and I love to fly, and so I owned and operated a Cirrus aircraft for several years. And after having quite an interesting year with first a bird strike early in the year, and then after about 8 months getting the plane back, I put it on lease back at a flight school. And about 6 weeks later, an instructor and student were out flying it and ended up spinning it and couldn't recover, and luckily had a full airframe parachute in the aircraft, pulled it, and fell down into the woods under a parachute canopy and ended up both walking away unharmed.
Wow. William.
So you're a risk taker with a parachute. How does that transfer to your company and your employees?
I think one of the biggest things is, number one, creating a very creative environment that people like to be in. And being a bit of a risk taker allows you to bring in customers and types of business that is different from other places that they might work. at the same time, the piloting concept and the risk taking is one of the biggest things that I've learned is about situational awareness and maintaining it, and being an enabler for your company, but also making sure that things are being done the right way.
Matt, traveling 55 countries, like you mentioned before, obviously gives you an appreciation for the opportunities we have in the United States. How have you passed that on to your children?
My children all have a love for travel as well, and so they are very open-minded. They've seen a lot of places around. They've seen from myself and their mother both a very open-mindedness about people and cultures and the value of what we have here in the United States and the opportunity and taking advantage of that.
You said you've been to 55 countries. What have you learned on your travels that you brought back to Exhibity?
I part of it, I think, has to do with kind of the open-mindedness concept, I think, is one of the biggest things, and realizing the value in people and diversity and cultures and background experiences. So really, you know, I've enabled the company by creating a framework, but it's really the people within the company. So I've hired people that are smarter than me to do the work. And we've also got a very diverse talent base where people have all sorts of different backgrounds to bring ideas and creative solutions for our clients.
All right.
Well, I know you mentioned in the green room that you did a lot of volunteering when you were young. How is that transferred into the culture of the company?
One of the things that we talk about constantly is mission enabling, mission first. And probably somewhat to the detriment of the company in the early years, we still do put client first. And we actually tell our employees, do the right thing for the client and we'll figure it out on the back end. And so the early years in volunteering was always about having to get the job done and doing it right for what had to happen at the time. And I think that's been really core into the culture of the company is to get mission, get it done, and we'll work it out.
What volunteer activities were you involved in as a child?
So early on, I ended up joining the Civil Air Patrol and did that for several years and was involved in search and rescue missions and some aviation education, things like that. And then I transitioned when I turned 18 into volunteer firefighting and EMT.
So what was the most satisfying thing about serving the Civil Air Patrol?
The most satisfying thing, wow. Part of it was exposure. It was had a little bit of a military component to it. It was definitely a service-oriented organization where we got to learn a lot about aviation and things like search and rescue. And just that very tactical kind of a response, having that adrenaline rush when things happened, were very interesting.
Matt, you've had several transitions throughout your professional career, also worked closely with the military. What advice could you give for military service members transitioning into the commercial sector now on job hunting and how to find employment?
Yeah, I would probably, one of the biggest things in coming out of the military, you have a drive for mission. You will do whatever it takes to get the job done. And that's a key quality coming into any company where I think as an executive, you just know if you assign somebody or ask them to do something, they're going to find a way to do it. And that's something that can't be undervalued. It's not an education coming out of school. I've had to do this, and whatever it takes, however long it takes, I will make it happen. And we really do appreciate that as employers. It's unique.
So Civil Air Patrol, working with the military, how did you get involved in being a firefighter?
I mentioned my two older brothers did it, and it was one of those things where the adrenaline rush at the time of we'd be sitting around the dinner table and pagers would go off and we'd all exit the dinner table and go rush off, and so I wanted that, so I joined up, and my poor parents, we would have dinner on the table, the beepers would go off, we'd disappear, and we'd come back a couple hours later talking about some gory story that we just experienced and eat dinner at the same time, and that was a family time for us.
Sounds very wholesome, I guess. Yeah. I'm sensing a dual thread of risk and service here. How do those play out at Exhibity?
I think we, from a risk standpoint, part of it's hiring. We hire people who are willing to take risks and are interesting, and I believe that they we want to push the boundaries of technology, but we also do it in a way that we can manage the risks so we don't create an issue for our customers.
So what special problems are created when you hire people that are smarter than you? Aren't you supposed to be the smartest guy as the president?
No, I would actually quite say the contrary to that. I really see my role as being an enabler and providing the framework and then bringing clients and funding to the table for them and then watching the amazing things that happens when you bring those engineers with the kind of client that we have.
You told us a story about taking a small risk or leap of faith recently in Telluride. What happened there?
Loaded question. Be careful what you say in the green room, number one. So I recently got engaged and ended up popping the question in Telluride. Both of us very outdoorsy. She's CFO of a company, and we both get each other. We have a basis of trust that is just amazing. And so we were in a place that was beautiful and on a big boulder, which is a representation of the solid foundation of the relationship. And
congratulations on that. What's the website of Exivity?
It's exivity.com.
You've been speaking, or we've been speaking, with Matt Ramsey. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Schuhart from Graybeard Coaching, with my co-hosts from Cressa, Mindy Saffer, and Lauren Rizzo. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Shantanu Agrawal, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum. Shantanu, what is the National Quality Forum?
Sure. Thanks for having me here. So the National Quality Forum brings together all of the major stakeholders in healthcare, from industry to patients, health systems, physicians, other providers and clinicians, with the federal government in order to improve healthcare quality.
How large or how small is the forum?
So we have about a $22 million budget, and we employ about 85 people.
And how did you get a job with the forum?
Yeah, so I've been in this role now for just over a year and a half. I came most directly out of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the federal agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid and the marketplace, the exchanges. And this was a great opportunity to really make sure that I was involved in the big national dialogue on quality and quality improvement, working with all of the right stakeholders and still close to the policy environment, even though we are a private entity.
Okay. Where are you from?
I grew up in Northwest Ohio in a small town called Findlay.
And how'd you get to Findlay?
It was a very long route. My family emigrated from India when I was 4 years old. So we first moved initially to Detroit, which is where my uncle lived. He sponsored us. He was a lifelong engineer with the Ford Motor Company. And so we moved to the Detroit area and then moved to Toledo for my dad's medical training, and then Findlay, Ohio.
So that's a pretty big step, moving from India when you were 4 years old. What prompted your folks to move to the USA?
It was the American dream. That's what it came down to. My parents had great educations in India, I think had great lives. We were doing well, and they really felt that they wanted to give more to me, and then ultimately me and my brother.
Mm-hmm. And you have one brother?
I have a younger brother, yeah.
Okay. And what do you get from your mom?
My mom is a very determined and outspoken individual. She trained as a lawyer, practiced as a lawyer in India. She was one of two women in her graduating class, and will share that she went to law school because she had an uncle that told her that women can't become lawyers. And that's pretty much who my mom is. If you put a challenge in front of her, she will absolutely take it. So we have definitely, I think, gotten that attitude from her. I also will say I think my mom is sort of the ethical center of the family. She taught me a lot about policy and society and the role of government in society. She was a big fan growing up in India of John F. Kennedy and really passed down those virtues to all of us.
So your foundation, your interest in policy work, sounds like it stems from your mom.
Yeah, my mom really has a very strong view about, the role of government and how we as a country take care of people. And it really doesn't matter what country that is. Her views have not changed that dramatically coming from India to America. And she has definitely passed that on. I know that I watch her as she passes it on to my children, just as she did to me.
Yeah. Tell us about your dad.
My dad is a practicing anesthesiologist in Findlay. He was an ophthalmologist in India. Then when we came here, you know, physicians have to often retrain in America. And so he became an anesthesiologist at that point. He absolutely loves medicine. He retired for 3 months last year and just missed it too much and decided he had to go back. He is definitely, you know, one of these people that is passionate about healthcare, loves it every single day, loves every aspect of it, and has definitely passed that on to me as well.
Mindy?
So when you were growing up, what would you say the biggest challenges were having parents that, you know, English was not their first language? What did you feel and what did you experience?
Yeah, I feel like in many ways I experienced the typical immigration story. We were always, and probably even today, are a family in transition. We feel like we exist between two countries. My parents, you know, definitely came with a set of values and a set of kind of ideals around hard work and determination and education in order to make it in America. We came without a lot of resources except for their education, and so I take that really seriously. You know, and I think that has been a huge part of my upbringing. I remember what it was like not to have a lot. I totally emphasize to my children the need to work hard and get educated the way that my parents emphasized it to me. And, you know, I feel like we will always be an immigrant family to our core. I don't know how many generations I have to go by before we don't necessarily feel that way. But I think it's an important thing to feel that way.
How do you deal with making difficult decisions? You were a physician, you went through all that training, and then you transitioned over to a nonprofit. What was that like for you?
For me, it felt really natural. It wasn't a hard choice. I still very much think like a physician. It's a huge part of my background, just the way I view healthcare. I still try to keep current, and when I can, work clinically. But I've always wanted to have broader healthcare impact, both to understand the healthcare system from a broader perspective or vantage point, and then to have broader impact than I could have in my practice alone. So I knew when I was choosing medicine in college that I wasn't going to be 100% clinician, that I wasn't going to be on the traditional clinical path. So once I made that choice and still decided to go into medicine, it actually wasn't hard to get off the path. It felt very natural for me.
Yeah, you told us earlier you, of course, were interested in science as a kid, but you also mentioned science fiction. Yeah. Tell us about how you got interested in science fiction.
Well, it must have been a natural part of my thinking, but, you know, when we first moved to America, I mentioned, you know, not having a lot, and one of the things that we did do as a family is we went to the movies, and one of the first movies that I saw, so we landed in Detroit on a British Airways flight in November 1980. And one of the first movies that I saw was The Empire Strikes Back, sort of the second installment of the Star Wars series. And I didn't understand much of it. I hadn't seen Star Wars. That was problematic. Didn't really know English that well, but it was stunning to see Star Wars. I can still remember the feeling of being in that movie theater. And I have to say, probably I fell in love with science fiction that day, and probably I fell in love with space and America that day.
Well, quite an introduction to America.
Yeah, it was incredible. Part of me thought that it was real, and that America was actually a country capable of doing that. I have never sort of forgotten that emotion, and I've never forgotten sort of feeling how great America was since then.
What's your website, Shantanu?
So it's qualityforum.org.
We've been speaking with Shantanu Agrawal, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum. Our guests today have been Bill Dombey, President of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice, Luz Coscio, CEO of the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association, Matt Ramsey, President and CEO of Exivity, and Shantanu Agrawal, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum. I'd like to thank my co-hosts from CRESA, Mindy Saffer and Lauren Rizzo, for helping develop our stories today and hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. Also, I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a great day. Bye-bye.